Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org. Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I am Matthew Gage, and this is lesson number 3 in our series on Bible history and customs. And today we will be looking at the temple sacrifices and services. Now, if you have one of the older versions of the notes, I originally had a different lesson scheduled, and I've changed my mind. We're going to push back that lesson probably till next time, covering different kingdoms and nations and stuff. But this is a lesson I kind of got in our previous lesson, covering the different, when we talked about the Jewish calendar and some of the different feasts and stuff. I really wanted to go a little bit more in depth, and I didn't want to go back and just rehash, because I talked a little bit about what the particular holidays would be, you know, the Day of Atonement, and stuff like that. I didn't want to go back and just redo those. I wanted to kind of cover a little bit different ground. So what I decided to do originally was just take a look at kind of the daily services, kind of what was the pattern, what was the schedule, you know, what happened on a daily basis, excuse me, in the temple, especially around the time of Christ. And so that kind of led me down this path studying that. And before I was done, I ended up with a little over 3 pages worth of notes, and that's just outline form. That's by far, I believe, the longest outline or notes I've used to record one of these. Excuse me. And ended up then kind of getting into different things. You know, originally I was just going to talk about, well, you know, what did they do? What was the schedule, services and stuff, you know, at the temple. And then it got into, well, if I'm going to do that, I probably need to talk a little bit about, you know, what the temple is and kind of what some of the things are. And then I thought, well, if I'm covering what's going on in the temple, maybe I need to cover about the different types of offerings. So that led me down this long pathway to where, you know, it turns into what could be a very long lesson. I don't think so, because a lot of this information is I'm just going to be reading and not spending a whole lot of time on. I apologize. Now that I've started recording, my allergies are kind of acting up and starting to cough a little bit. But anyway, that's our plan for today, what we're going to cover. And I'm really looking forward to this. I was very excited to deal with this. This is one of the areas that we kind of gloss over when we study the Bible. And some of this, you really got to get away from the Bible and study Jewish history. And, you know, it's an area of study that we don't do a lot on. Now, perhaps in Sunday school or even like a Bible study series, you'll hear people talk about, you know, the types of Christ in the offerings and, you know, in the tabernacle furniture and stuff like that. Well, that's all very interesting, and I didn't want to go down that path per se. I really want to kind of cover it in more or less of something you might not have heard. But and even that, honestly, you know, when I got to studying some of this, I was learning quite a bit. And because it's stuff we don't cover. We just kind of gloss over in the Bible. And there's such rich history to the Jewish traditions and the Jewish history. Plus, there is there's a lot of types of Christ. We see, shadows of his sacrifice, of his atonement in these. And it's kind of a shame. I wish I could spend more time on it. I'm not going to. And really, so much of that gets into speculation that I kind of try to stay out of. So I didn't want to get too deep into that, to be honest. But what we're going to do is just, you know, kind of give you a good overview. And hopefully by the end of this, you'll have a good feeling for, you know, what took place at the temple and have a good idea about, you know, the different sacrifices and stuff. So let me go ahead and state up front that I'm mainly going to focus on how things operated at the time of Christ. there are different variations and slight changes that took place between the from the tabernacle to David's temple, or you know, or to Solomon's temple, excuse me, and then fast forwarding up to, you know, the time of Christ and the second temple period, Herod's temple. There's some very subtle changes that take place, but for the most part, especially when we get into the daily services, we are going to be focusing on how they did it during the time of Christ. And one of my major sources on this is Alfred Edersheim. He wrote a number of books, most of them about 100 years old, I believe. He was a Jewish person who became a Christian and is still considered today one of the leading experts when it comes to Jewish traditions in the light of Christianity. So he's got a book. I don't have it right here with me, but it's called The Temple. It's Services in the Time of Christ or something along those lines. It's kind of got a long title. But a lot of when we get to the day-to-day operation in the temple, I lean very heavily on that book. I did a little research on some different Jewish websites and such. But I lean very heavily on that book, especially when we get to the temple layout and the daily sacrifices and such. So let's get started. Let's deal with, first of all, we're going to look at the different types of offerings. And I have 8 different ones, I believe. Yeah. And some of these, I was learning some stuff as I looked at these, and I think you will too. The majority of these are found in the first few chapters, of the book of Leviticus. And the first one we'll look at is probably the most common, or one of the most common that you consider when you think of sacrifices. This is probably along the lines of what you would think of. And that is the burnt offering. And you'll find that described in Leviticus chapter 1. Now, some of these will have different references where you can track down some of this in different chapters in Leviticus or Numbers or Deuteronomy or somewhere. But I tried to just give you a basic reference. And some of this even, I'm trying to think. I don't know that I have anything like traditions and stuff in here. Mainly, this is just telling you what the Bible had. And I tried to lay out as much of it to give you an idea of what they did. But the first one is the burnt offering, Leviticus chapter 1. And it gets that name because it was to be burnt completely. And that's a little bit different than some of the other sacrifices. Some of the other sacrifices, portions of the sacrifice would go to the priest or to the sacrificer, should we say, the person bringing the sacrifice. So this one is a little bit different in that everything was burned. So that's how it gets its name, burnt offering. And there are a number of animals that are acceptable for this. And basically when we deal with this, when we have a whole list of animals like this, it kind of is based like on a scale of wealth. If you were very wealthy, you were supposed to bring the larger, more expensive sacrifice. But there were, if you were very poor, you still could bring a sacrifice and be, just as much a sacrifice and just as atoning, or, it's no different. One sacrifice isn't bigger than the other, but it's just based on, there's just doors left open for the poor folk to be able to also give sacrifice. Now, the different animals that were acceptable for this, a bull, lamb, goat, pigeon, or turtle dove. And we'll see that same list a couple of times. And it was supposed to be a male animal without blemish. And well, that's also very key. Is that, they didn't have broken legs or sores. These were supposed to be good animals. And we could go so much into typology and stuff like that. But, anything we offer to God shouldn't be leftovers or something that's junk. It should be the best we can offer. And also it talks about the sinlessness and perfectness of Christ. So there's all kinds of stuff we can get into. I'm trying not to chase those rabbits. But anyway, as far as the sacrifice itself with the burnt offering, this is kind of the ritual that would take place. The worshiper, or the person bringing the sacrifice, would place their hands on the head of the animal. And I believe they had a certain like prayer that they would say. And this was to show that, you know, this sacrifice was on their behalf. It could, you know, show that it was taking their sin. This is something you see like in with the Day of Atonement, that the priest would put his hands on the sacrifice. But anyway, they place their hands on the head of the animal. The sacrifice would then be killed. And as the blood would pour out, and if it was like a bull or a goat or something, they would slit their throat. Pigeons and turtle doves, I think they cut off their head or wrung their heads off or something like that. I don't remember exactly. I put these notes together last week. But anyway, they would catch the blood in a bowl, and they would sprinkle this blood around the altar. And they had a precise deal. They're the four horns on the altar in each corner. There, you know, it's kind of a little projection, that they call a horn. And they would sprinkle it at each of those, and then I think in the middle also. And they had a precise little symbol that they would do with this. Now, something unique to this one, and I'm not really sure exactly what the purpose or symbolism behind this is that when they would sacrifice this, and by the way, when they would do these sacrifices, a lot of times they didn't just slit throat and throw the body up there. They actually basically like butcher these animals and would cut them up and stuff. Well, in the case of burnt offering, they actually would cut the animals open, and they would wash certain parts of the animal with water, the entrails, the guts of the animal, and the legs. And like I said, I never really could find a good explanation why they did that, but that's just what they did. And then they would take the entire body and lay it out, you know, on the altar. And when they did that, they always tried to lay it out kind of in the form of the animal. So, you know, you tried to lay it out, you know, you didn't throw its liver up by its head. You tried to lay it out like it, in the same shape and form as the animal. And you lay it up there on the altar, and the entire sacrifice would be burned. Nothing was kept. It was totally given. And kind of the significance typology, this one speaks of the death of Christ, that he was completely given for our sins. It's kind of some of the typology that's there. The second offering is the meat offering, sometimes translated meal or grain offering. And that's probably a little bit better translation, kind of the way language has changed. This isn't meat as in we would think of meat, you know, you think of meat as a big T-bone steak. This really is grains. specifically, it would be wheat offering. You'll find this in Leviticus chapter 2. And there was a few acceptable ways to offer this. You would form a dough from the wheat flour, and you could either bake it in an oven, cook it on a griddle, fry it in a pan, or roast it to make bread. Those were kind of the four options. But basically, anyway, you come up with like a bread. And it had to have oil and salt in making it, but it could not have honey or leaven in it. So this is like a flat cake. It wouldn't be like a big loaf of bread since there was no leaven in it, it wouldn't rise. So you're talking more like, you know, like a pancake or a cracker. And something else kind of unique is these were supposed to be accompanied with frankincense. And I believe that's like they would put that on top of it, or I saw a couple different explanations on it, but I think they would kind of put that onto the little cake itself. And of course, frankincense is like an incense or a spice. So it's not really something normally that would be cooked with, but that was put on there. Now, as far as the sacrifice, what they would do with these cakes is part of it was pulled off by the priest and thrown on the altar and burned, but it appears to only be like a small portion. I'm not sure how big or what the ratio would be. But they would take a small portion of it, throw it on fire. Now, the rest of it, that was consumed by the priest. And this is part of, and we'll see this happen time and time again with these sacrifices. You know, this was for, you know, the priests to survive. This was how they kind of made their living. It was by God providing for them through these sacrifices. But now that is the way it would work if, you know, if just regular Joe went to the temple and offered a meat offering. In the cases where a priest would offer this for himself, which in some of the holidays and stuff, they would do that, the entire thing was burned. So there's a little bit difference there. The significance of this, it's offered for the sin of the offender. And a large portion of this went to the priest. And it's supposed to symbolically speak of the perfection or sinlessness of Christ, because there was no leaven. I mean, you know, Christ said he was, you know, the bread of life. And since there is no leaven, there, you know, which speaks of sin, is a perfect sacrifice. Okay, the third offering we'll look at is the peace offering. You'll find this in Leviticus chapter 3. And the peace offering is one that speaks of communion. Now, I don't get ahead of myself, but the significance of it is that it's not so much about atoning for sin as just celebrating the relationship with God, the way I kind of understand its purpose. The offering could be a male or female ox, sheep, or goat, and had to also, with this sacrifice, had to include unleavened cakes, just like a meat offering also. This kind of was two things involved in this. As far as the sacrifice goes, it's very similar to the burnt offering and how they would do it, but only some of the fat and some of the entrails of the animal were burned. And then what was not burned was actually taken and split between the priests and the worshiper, the person who brought the sacrifice, and they would eat this. The priest would eat it then, the worshiper would take it back home and eat it. And so that kind of goes talking about the, you know, that this was a communion, it was a celebration deal. You know, they were taking part of the sacrifice, and the cakes were treated just like a meat offering. It's just like a meat offering was included with the peace offering. And the significance of this, like I said, it talks about the communion with God. This is kind of more of a celebration type thing to look at. They're not really making atonement for sin or paying for sin. This whole thing is just this symbol symbolizing that the worshiper is on good grounds with God. And we could look at this and say, you know, that this symbolizes the peace we have, the relationship we have with God through Christ. Okay, the fourth offering is the sin offering. And this one gets a little bit more complicated. It's in Leviticus chapter 4. And there's three different levels of sin offering based upon who you were. For the high priest, he had to offer a bull. He had to, the blood would be taken, sprinkled seven times on the altar, but the blood would not be poured out. I believe they actually like poured it out the base of the altar, if I remember right. The fat of the animal, so they would basically butcher these animals. They would take the fat and burn it on the altar, but the rest of the animal, the body, the carcass of the animal, would be taken outside the camp, outside the city, to the trash heap, basically, where the ashes from the altar, when they cleaned out the ashes every day, they dump those out. That's where they would take and burn the rest of the body. But that's how it worked for the high priest. If you're a leader, which I guess that could be religious or political, it's not very clear that I remember, you offered a male goat. And okay, wait, I misspoke. When it talked about the blood sprinkled, they sprinkled the blood seven times on the altar. The rest of that blood was not poured for the high priest, and they took it out and burned it with the body. That's what happened. As I'm reading the rest of this, it's coming back to me. But if you were a leader, you offered a male goat. The blood was sprinkled only once on the altar, and the rest of it is poured around the altar. It was not burned with it. And so then the rest of the animals burned on the altar. And then if you were just, you know, a common Joe, regular people, you could offer female goats, lambs, turtle doves, or pigeons based upon, how rich you were. And if you were very, very, very poor, you could offer just grain as a meat offering. And the significance of this is dealing with unintentional sins. This was, dear God, I probably messed up. I don't even realize it. And this is to take care of it. And the symbolism there is that Christ is the sin bearer, that he took away not just sins that we know and confess, but that all our sins, even the ones we didn't mean to do, unintentional, unknown, all of those were borne by Christ and dealt with. Okay, the fifth offering is the trespass offering, also called the guilt offering. And you can read about this Leviticus chapter 5 and then on into the first 7 verses of chapter 6. Because there's a little kind of an addendum in chapter 6 to it. And here are the requirements to offer this. This isn't just one you just went and offered like some of the rest of these. You could go offer a peace offering, just any time, or a burnt offering. You could go and give those basically any time. If you'd sinned, you could go get, do a burnt offering or something. But, there really was no requirements as to, do this. If you sin, go do this. Or, the priest would say, well, I'm sorry, you're not qualified. You can't do this. Well, there's very specific reasons given to offer a trespass offering. And that would be failing to be a truthful witness or lying as a witness, like in a judicial type case, or even unintentionally bearing false witness, that if you were tricked or misinformed or something, you would still offer a trespass offering. Ceremonial uncleanness. This is, touching a dead body, things like that. You would offer a trespass offering. And then also swearing a false oath, basically, making a pledge and not carrying it through. That's would be require a trespass offering. And then the sacrifice could be, based on wealth, a female goat, lamb, turtle doves, pigeons, or if you were very, very poor, you could offer what's described as 1/10 ephah of flour. That's roughly 2 dry quarts. So, that's not very much at all. Now, additionally, this is where it gets a little bit more complicated. It's depending on what you did, there could be a little bit extra. If you damaged a holy thing, something in the temple or something, additionally, you'd be required to offer the trespass offering plus financial repayment, which is equal to the replacement value or the amount taken, spoiled, destroyed, whatever. But you'd be required to repay the value plus an additional 20%, which went to the priests. And then additionally, if you ignorantly committed fraud, this would be, you weren't meaning to rip somebody off in a business transaction, but you accidentally did. You would offer the trespass offering, and then in financial repayment, you would, and I couldn't quite figure this out, and I may have just misread it, but you had to give an amount equal to what was taken or cheated or fraudulent. And I couldn't understand if that went to the temple or to the person that was taken from. I believe it went to the person that was taken from. And then additional 20% on top of that went to the priest. And then another additional 20% went to the person it was fraudulently taken from, from the offended. And the significance of the trespass offering is that it speaks of Christ taking care of the sins of the believer. And those are the 5 main types of offerings. Sometimes they're called the Levitical offerings because they're there in the first few chapters of Leviticus. 3 other ones I want to cover just very quickly are a little less common, but I want, and that's kind of the reason I want to cover them, just so you'll understand what they are. first one is the heave offering. This would be the sixth offering we've looked at, but it would be the first of these three. And the heave offering, heave basically, it's not like heave, ho, and push on something. It means lifted. Lifted apart from a larger quantity would be a good translation of what we translate, or what they translate heave as. And this was kind of a gift or a tax. And it was given, for example, redemption of the firstborn child, and also the tithe of the first fruits of harvest. And that was our cases where the heave offering was required. This was, okay, those were given to the temple. Also for the priests, speaking of this, you know, they had the general tithes that people gave were given and went to the support of the priests. And then the portion of the sacrifices that went to the priest, you know, such as with the meat offerings or even the peace offering, where, you know, the priest would take part of that, that was classified as a heave offering since it was lifted apart and separated, you know, for another purpose. Next, we have the drink offering. You read about this in Numbers 15. And this one is, this one's a little different. It's, this was a drink. This was what the Bible describes as wine. We would, you know, say grape juice nowadays. And it's described as strong wine. That's not alcoholic wine. That's talking about pure wine. It has not been watered down. That's a better way to describe it. And this actually accompanied the daily burnt offerings that we'll talk about here in a little bit. And it was poured out with the offering on the altar. And the significance kind of this is that, you know, it talks about joy and rest is kind of pictured with that, the picture of the wine there. And that is, you know, through these sacrifices that we have rest because of the sacrifice of Christ. That's kind of the symbolism there. Next, we have the wave offering, the last one we're going to look at. And this one accompanied all the peace offerings as part of the peace offering process. And basically, this was just an act representing that you are presenting the sacrifice to God. And this usually seems to take place with, especially with like meat offerings and stuff. And it literally means that they waved it in the air. That's why it's called a wave offering, is that they would lift up, you know, the loaf or the cake or whatever, however you want to describe it, and then wave it as if they were presenting it to God. And then anything that was waved as a wave offering was not burned, that I understand. It went to the priest, and that portion was reserved for the priests. And that covers the kind of the seven major types, at least the five major types and three, you know, kind of, I don't know, minor or less common types of offerings. So we should have probably just called that a lesson right there, covering that. But I want to keep going and just kind of have one big lesson on the temple and the sacrifices and stuff. Very quickly, so we come into our second section, I want to cover the temple layout. And at the time of Christ, the temple complex was going under major renovation, major construction by King Herod. King Herod was trying to beautify his kingdom and brought in a lot of like Greek architectural styles and tried to make his kingdom on par with the beauty of other places throughout, you know, the Roman Empire. And part of that, you know, for his sake and kind of also as a big carrot for the people, was the major rebuilding of the temple complex. And the temple itself was on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. If you look at a map of Jerusalem, it's on the east side of the city. And it's a little hill. It's surrounded on with valleys, the Kidron Valley on the right side, and then one that starts with a T, Tyrophian, something like that, valley on the left. If you're looking north-south, you know, the Kidron be on the east and the other one on the west. And basically under Herod, the whole entire hill was turned into a giant complex and was built up. They built up walls and backfilled it to even increase the size of the hill itself. And so it wasn't just the temple that was up there. It was a vast complex. The Sanhedrin, I believe, met there. And this was a major gathering place. And you know, there were storage places. There was places, you know, for like, you know, the money changers and such. They were all around there. But the main thing I want to focus on is kind of the temple itself, which kind of was on more of the northern, a little bit on the northern side of this, of the hill. And you can look up and see good diagrams and models and maps of this, but I just want to kind of describe it. The only way into the temple proper itself was from the east side. And as you're kind of entering into this, there was a walled off area. And there was one gate, and that gate is what we believe to be the beautiful gate that's described in the book of Acts that go in this. And as you walked into that, you entered what was called the Court of Women. And these different areas were so named because that was kind of how far these groups of people could go. There actually was a, you know, Court of the Gentiles that was further outside of that. And then, you know, the Gentiles could not go any further into the temple complex. Well, in this case, this court was as far as a woman could go. So it was called the Court of Women. Here also, kind of a major feature of this little area, there are some different storerooms and stuff in this area. But it's the temple treasury. This is where people would go and give their money. And it, the different money that was given for the temple was there. They actually had different chests and things where, you know, you could deposit your money. Going closer into the temple itself, you would come up what's called the Nicanor Gate. And that would actually go in to the temple courtyard itself, shall we say. And this next courtyard that went into is called the Court of Israel. And this was kind of just the first little bit inside to the temple courtyard. And this was free access to the men of Israel. And then there was a little bit of a partition there to what became between the Court of Israel. As you kept going closer to the temple itself, it became the Court of the Priests. And this is where we get into the, like, where the temple furniture would be, because only the priests were, you know, to be allowed in this area. And so this is the area directly in front of the temple itself. And as you're coming in from the east, facing the west, to your right side, kind of on the north side of the Court of the Priests, were the slaughter tables where they would, you know, butcher the sacrifices and cut them up and stuff. To the left, to the south side, would be the large brazen altar, the great altar, where the sacrifices were burned. And then kind of behind that, a little bit further to the west, I believe, is where the laver, where, you know, they had the water to wash with, that was placed there. And then that gets us to, as we kind of continue traveling through here, you know, going from east to west, gets us to the temple building itself. And as you went into the large double doors, there were steps going up into it. As you opened up these two, I think, I'm pretty sure it was two large wooden doors, and went inside, you entered what was called the Holy Place. And there's three things, or three types of things, I guess you should say, that were in here. There was the golden candlestick. Now, on the day of the temple, there was just one golden candlestick. But when they built the temple, they added quite a few. And I believe there were seven, if I remember correctly, golden candlesticks actually in the Holy Place at this time. And then those were on the left or the south side as you walked in. On the right or the north side was the table of showbread. That was the bread that was, it was baked and placed in there for each Sabbath and placed there as a sacrifice. And then going, keep going straight in, you would come to the golden altar or the altar of incense. And it gets a little confusing as you read sometimes some of the accounts and descriptions because, you know, you have the two altars and they won't describe them. The altar outside where they burn the sacrifices is sometimes called the brazen altar or the great altar or sometimes just called the altar. This altar was smaller. It was made of gold. So sometimes it's called the golden altar. Sometimes it's called the altar of incense. This is where the priests would come in to offer incense for God. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. For instance, Zacharias, John the Baptist's dad. This is where he was offering incense. This is where he was, what he was doing when the angel appeared to him. Directly behind that, as we keep going west, is the veil. This split the inside of the temple building itself into two areas. The holy place that we've just went through, and the Holy of Holies, which was the furthest back to the west. And this veil is the veil that was rent after Christ died. And it was there's supposed to be a magnificent tapestry that was woven, and it's supposed to be very beautiful by all traditions and accounts. And then finally, on the other side of the veil is the Holy of Holies, the holiest place. And this is the place in the tabernacle where the Ark of the Covenant would have been kept. At the time of Christ, though, every account we have says that the Ark of the Covenant is gone. It has disappeared. And this isn't really the place to get into all the theories about that. There's different theories about, well, Solomon gave it to the Queen of Sheba, or their son, his son by the Queen of Sheba took it back to Egypt, that it was carried away to Babylon, that the Jews hid it and just never brought it back out. There's lots of different theories. I don't want to get into that. Or, you know, if you watch Indiana Jones, it's hidden in Egypt and the Nazis get it. Now it's in a warehouse, you know, in Area 51 or wherever. But, you know, there's different theories about where that ended up. But by this time, there was no Ark of the Covenant in there. The only thing that was in there was, and by the way, also that meant the Shekinah glory of God that rested upon the tabernacle and the temple was not there at this time, by the way, also. And the only thing that was in there is what was called the foundation stone. And we know very little that I can find out about what this was. Some people, said this was the place where, you know, the ark used to rest or whatever, but basically there was a large flat rock, and some modern theories on that is that if you go over to the Temple Mount area today and you've got the Mosque of Omar that the Muslims built, inside there's a deal called, I believe it's called the Foundation Stone, and they, you know, some people believe that that is the foundation stone that's talked about here. That's where the Holy of Holies was. And that's where in the days of Solomon that the Ark of the Covenant would have rested. I don't know that, but it's just kind of interesting to think something so vital to the tabernacle is not there. And this was the only thing there. And which makes it interesting. The one day of the year they're supposed to go on the Day of Atonement. Go in there, did they sprinkle blood on this thing? Did they use it in place of the Ark of the Covenant? What did they do? I'm kind of curious about that. But anyway, just we could get into a bunch of different theories, and the whole Ark of the Covenant thing turns into, you almost get into, it's like searching for the lost city of Atlantis. There's so many wild theories out there about it, and it's like movies have been made about it, and it gets kind of crazy. But anyway, that's a description kind of the temple proper, the layout of it. If you have a little trouble following that, you can look up a picture. In fact, in the back of your Bible, there's probably some type of a picture or a map of or a layout of the temple complex and the temple itself. Okay. That leads me finally, after almost 39 plus minutes here, to what I originally wanted this lesson to be, and that is, what did they do in the temple? You know, did they just wake up in the morning, show up and start, you know, killing sacrifices that people brought? You know, what did they do? Well, I just want to cover very quickly, hopefully, the general order of service, what they did on a daily basis in the temple. And this would start early in the morning, pre-dawn. And not to even get into the stuff that happened at night. That's kind of interesting. The guards and stuff that they had at night. The captain of the temple that is spoken of in the book of Acts. He was kind of a night watchman or in charge of security and stuff. But anyway, pre-dawn, the officiating priests, which there was a rotation that went through different priests would and families of priests would be working at the temple for each week. But in the pre-dawn hours, they would meet, and the first lot was cast, and to choose. And there's four different lots that are cast to choose who will do different tasks during the day. The first lot was to prepare the altar, and these people would go out and clean out the ashes from the altar. Now the flames never totally went out. You know, there was always coals and embers at least. But they would go clean out all the ashes from the wood, from the sacrifices, clean it out, and go and dispose of those. They would also place new, fresh wood onto the altar. A second lot is cast shortly after, and this one actually there's quite a bit that goes on with it. This lot. Is who would offer the morning sacrifice, then who would go in to cleanse the candlestick and prepare the incense for offering incense in the temple itself. Three blasts of the silver trumpet would announce that the temple was going to be open and that the service was going to begin. And the temple gates would open, and there was appointed people to come in. And this is kind of, you know, somebody, if you were somebody, you could be there or be asked to be there. And then also, I mean, basically anybody could come in at that point and observe and be part of this service. As the gates are open, they tried to time this out where they would offer a lamb. And this was the usual morning sacrifice that they did. And they tried to time it out where they were killing the lamb just as soon as the doors opened. They tried to, you know, time it that way. And as this lamb was being killed, they would catch the blood in a bowl, take the blood, and sprinkle it on the altar. And at the same time, inside the temple itself, the priests that were chosen by lot are in there removing the old ashes and stuff from the altar of incense that's sitting in front of the veil. And then another priest would be trimming the wicks and refilling the lamps, the golden candlesticks. And kind of a strange thing, evidently, there was like seven of them in there, and they only did five right now. They would do two after this incense was altered. But anyway, that's something I don't understand, but they did it. After, the morning sack, with all this going on, a third lot is cast. And this is who will get to offer incense. And then whoever this lot fell on would then choose two friends or two helpers to help him in the process. A fourth lot is cast, the last one, and this is who will actually go offer the sacrifices, who the lamb that's been killed, who will go and actually, offer that as a sacrifice. The process for offering incense, the two helper guys, one would go and get coals off of the altar in a golden bowl. The other would get the incense and prepare it in a golden censer. As they prepared to go in to the temple itself, the priests and Levites would stop what they were doing and begin to sing. And they had a rotation of different songs, the way I understand it, that they would sing. you know, which are Psalms. We can actually, you know, have those. The two assistants, the two helpers, would the one would spread the coals on the altar of incense, and the other would prepare the incense and arrange it on the censer. They then leave the temple, leaving only the one that's going to offer the incense. And as he's in there by himself, outside the crowd goes silent. And that must have been something. I just met as the two priests exit. I understand they would shut the doors. The one priest is in there by himself, and then everybody goes silent. No more singing, nothing going on. This crowd outside is silent. And then after the incense has been offered, they would finish offering the lamb that was killed earlier on the altar. The priest would offer a blessing, which was Numbers chapter 6, verses 24 through 26 has that. And then the various meat and drink offerings are made as part of the sacrifice. And then the choir of Levites would sing the designated psalm of the day. And then after that is done, they would then go about their business offering the various sacrifices that would come. Now, that would open up the day at the temple. In closing out the day, they would have the evening sacrifice, which would take place around 3 o'clock. It's supposed to be, I guess it's the ninth hour, but usually, you know, kind of late afternoon, a few hours before sunset. And it's actually, the entire process is very, very similar to the way they did the morning sacrifice, except they only cast one lot in the process, because whoever got the lot in the morning preparing the sacrifices and offering the sacrifices and all that, they continued on and did that, you know, the chore in the morning and the evening. But the one lot that was cast was who would go in to offer incense. So someone different would go in the evening to do that. And he would pick two new helpers to go in and help him do that. Now, there's a few slight differences, but basically the same general outline of service. One is that the incense was burned after the sacrifice was laid on the altar. So they would go ahead and have the lamb on the altar, you know, being burned before the guy went in there to offer the incense, which is backwards from the way it was in the morning. Also, the priestly blessing from the Book of Numbers, that was usually generally omitted. They did not do that. But basically everything else, the same processes, cleaning out the altar and offering the lamb and the choir singing, everything else basically is the same. Now, as far as the Sabbath day, you know, I thought to myself, wow, well, they must have done something really special on the Sabbath. And now, they did not observe the sabbatical rest, you know, ceasing from work and stuff on the Sabbath day in the temple. In fact, the priest had a saying that, you know, there is no Sabbath in the temple. But surprisingly to me, at least, when it was a Sabbath, basically it was the same outline. They do basically the same thing. They really don't do a whole lot of special stuff on the Sabbath. It takes a little bit different, beginning late Friday afternoon, because, you know, the Sabbath would start sundown on Friday. And they would blow trumpets during the evening sacrifice to signal that the Sabbath was, you know, about to start. After the evening sacrifice has been offered, they would clean the altar itself from bloodstains. And I don't have any details on how they did that, but they would do that on Friday evening before the Sabbath started. After the sun went down, very soon after sun went down, they would have baked fresh showbread and have went into the temple and replaced the bread that was on the table of showbread. So fresh bread is placed there, what we would consider Friday evening, but be the beginning of the Sabbath, just shortly after dark. And then what other differences were there? They actually would offer two lambs in the morning instead of one. And the song service was a little bit different. They would have different psalms that they would do. But basically everything else, as far as the order, and the lots that are cast, everything else is essentially the same. And that covers it. That is a general outline of a day in the life of a temple priest, of what was going on in the temple on an average day. So there you go. Wow. I was really expecting this to be like an hour and a half long to cover all this. And we're going to get you out of there in a little over 50 minutes. I'm very pleased that this didn't go much longer than I was afraid with how long my outline went. But anyway, I hope that gives you a little bit better understanding. I had to fly through so much of that, and honestly, I didn't have the time to really dig in as much as I would love to learn about this. But I hope that, if anything else, give you a good kind of general understanding of what would happen with the offering and the temple itself. And maybe this, if nothing else, this will kind of pique your interest and you'll want to go in and study some yourself. There's so much there to study, especially if you get into all the rabbinical writings that the Jews had and how they thought about and their philosophies and their arguments over how the offering should be offered. But anyway, that is it. That's lesson number 3, temple sacrifices and services. I appreciate you listening. And for more resources, check out BaptistBasics.org. Follow us on Facebook. You can download the podcast on iTunes. I'd love it if you'd leave a rating there. That'd be super nice if you did. Email me, podcast@BaptistBasics.org. And join us next time. And unless I change my mind, which I did for this lesson, lesson number 4, we will cover different nations and empires that the Israelites took care of. Just kind of a broad history of some of the major players in Bible history. So anyway, that's it. I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening today. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you.